Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Richard Cross on behalf of Delta Eta Corporation. With me today is Amy Evans in our appeal.
Ms. Evans, the custom is when you're introduced to the court to stand.
Thank you.
In an appeal today in the case of Delta Eta Corporation versus University of Delaware, there's also a cross appeal by the University of Delaware. The issue on the appeal is the calculation of prejudgment interest in our case. I won't go through all of the background facts, but in this case, the university terminated a lease early with Delta Eta, and as a result of that, it triggered what was an agreement by the parties referred to as the Chapter House Reimbursement Schedule. Under that schedule, there was an appraisal taken, and after the appraisal was taken, there were limited modifications to that price based on the cost of the appraisal and sums that Delta Eta would have owed to the university over the balance of the lease. Under the Chapter House Reimbursement Schedule, once that calculation was made, it was transmitted to the university. The university would have 90 days to make that payment. As the Chapter House Reimbursement Schedule makes clear, the full reimbursement for the payment by the university was for, quote, full reimbursement for the early transfer of title and possession of the Chapter House from the fraternity to the university. The language of the Chapter House Reimbursement Schedule says nothing, for example, about a full release of all claims that the fraternity may have against the university. It's simply limited to a payment for full reimbursement for the early transfer of title and possession. There's no call in the reimbursement schedule for the fraternity to provide a written release or any other kind of release to the university.
Is one implied by the use of the phrase full reimbursement?
I don't believe one is, Your Honor. If you look at the cases that say that you can demand, for example, a release, the cases that were cited by the parties discuss that a release is a condition of payment, for example. And here there's no such language. The other aspect to that, Your Honor, is even if it was implied that a release would be necessary, it would certainly be limited. The release that would be required would be limited to what's being released, which is the Chapter House being turned back over to the university. So in other words, there was a lease, an additional lease, and then a sublease, and what was being terminated were those leases. So if there was going to be a release of any kind, it would have to do with claims that related to those leases and subleases. What occurred in this case was, as per the Chapter House Reimbursement Schedule, appraisal was done, calculation was made, and the number was transmitted to the University of Delaware in August of 2006. The number after the adjustments was $768,500. There is no dispute that number, all else being, I guess, okay, would have been due and owing on November 30, 2006. The issue in this case is that date came and went, and the university said that they would not pay it, absent being given a release and quitclaim signed by Delta Eta. The problem with the release and quitclaim, as I alluded, is it called for far more than a release of relating to the early transfer of title and possession. And I think it's important to look at what the university was demanding at that time. And this is in our appendix, page A317 and 318. It said, in consideration and satisfaction of the provisions of this release and quitclaim, the university and fraternity, hereby knowingly and willingly, remise, waive, release, and discharge each other, any of their respective subsidiaries, divisions, related and affiliated entities, and their predecessors and successors, and their present and future officers, directors, employees, agents, heirs, successors, and assigns in both their individual and official capacities, of and from any and all manner of actions, causes of actions, suits, debts, dues, accounts, bonds, covenants, contracts, agreements, judgments, and claims whatsoever in law or equity, which either party and its heirs, executors, administrators, or assigns has or may have against the releasees. And then it says, importantly, including the claims arising under the ground lease, supplemental lease, sublease, reimbursement schedule, and appraisal. So it's clear that what the university wanted was far more than a release from those leases and sublease. They wanted all potential claims that the parties may have. The result, Delta Eta came back to the university and said they were willing to provide a release, even though we didn't believe that the chapter house reimbursement schedule required a release. We were willing to give one, but it was going to be limited to any causes of action related to the lease, supplemental lease, and sublease. The university rejected that and said they would not do that, and so ultimately we ended up in litigation. There were other claims that Delta Eta was pressing against the university. As I said in the beginning, the chapter house reimbursement schedule was looking to a reimbursement for the early termination of the lease, and looked at what were the remaining payments due, the stream of payments that would have been due under the lease, and giving an appraised value, and then deducting from it amounts Delta Eta would have owed to the university. There's no language in that chapter house reimbursement schedule that looks to any claims that Delta Eta may have had against the university, and certainly wasn't looking at any claims that already existed, for example, or would be looking back. It was only essentially looking forward at reimbursing them for having early terminated. What Delta Eta believed they were entitled to were some additional things. Number one, the university now had complete possession and control of the house, but was not paying anything for it. And therefore, Delta Eta said, well, if you're going to continue to hold the property until we reach this deal, then you've got to pay rent if you're taking it from us and the lease hasn't terminated yet. They also said, under the terms of the agreement, they believed if the university had made a certain amount of profit over the use of that property, using it as a dormitory, that Delta Eta would be entitled to some of that profit. They also said that there were certain improvements that the university made to it that Delta Eta didn't believe they were required to pay, although the university had demanded and gotten payment from Delta Eta for, particularly a security system and a bike rack. So Delta Eta was pressing those claims separate from the reimbursement on this. And I think what's important here, because what the university tries to, I think, say is that as long as you had any other claims, even though they're not contemplated in the chapter house reimbursement schedule, as long as there's any other claim out there, we don't know the final number and we don't have to pay. But what's important, I guess, is on December 4, 2006, and this is in the appendix at page 322, is when we sent a letter to the university and made clear that with respect to this chapter house reimbursement schedule, we were looking for the sum of $768,500. It had nothing to do with any of the other claims that were outside of that chapter house reimbursement schedule. And again, what we were willing to do was to provide them a release for the lease and the subleases, even though we didn't believe it was necessary. And if the university wanted to then argue that the result of that was that those other claims went away, they would have that argument and that defense that they could raise. Now, what happened was the parties ended up going through litigation in the Superior Court. Ultimately, the Superior Court found that Delta Eta was entitled to the $768,500. The court made that determination in a summary judgment decision dated October 31, 2008, and determined that prejudgment interest would begin to run from 90 days after that, which would trying to be, I guess, consistent with the language in the chapter house reimbursement schedule, that it would be 90 days after the sum was determined. It's our position that it's improper to wait until the court decides in summary judgment that we're owed that money. The court's decision essentially is, yes, that original appraisal, which came out to $768,500, which was transmitted in August of 2006, was correct. So the university owed that money back in 2006, even though they disputed it. And once the court determined that they did owe that money, we should have been entitled to interest from that time. The university had complete possession and control of the property from that time forward. Meanwhile, Delta Eta had a mortgage and note on the building that had been on that property, was still required to pay that to the bank, had no source of income to pay it, was in default on that, and was accruing interest and penalties on its large debt. And the reason it was doing that was because the university, which had complete possession and control, had never paid anything it was required to under this chapter house reimbursement schedule. As we sit here,
hypothetically, the court decided that the revised appraisal should have been accepted by the Superior Court. When would prejudgment interest run from your position then?
Well, I guess it would change. It would certainly change things if the court determined that a second appraisal was permitted, and we disagree that it would be permitted. Then presumably the number was not established back in August of 2006. But that doesn't...
Does it run 90 days from February 20th, 08, if that's the date of the revised appraisal?
Presumably it would. But we don't believe that there's any language in the Chapter House reimbursement schedule that permits any sort of amended or second appraisal. What the parties agreed was that there was a certain mechanism that would be used. They used it. Nobody disputed that the manner in which the original appraisal was done was improper. Nobody argued that there was any bias. Nobody argued that there was any improper influence or that anybody was misled. And no one's ever challenged that. What the university wants to do is say, we didn't like the outcome of that original appraisal. We learned information subsequently. We then contacted the appraiser and went out of our way to ask them to make a new appraisal. That in itself goes against what's permitted under the Chapter House reimbursement schedule. The Chapter House reimbursement schedule specifically says, quote, neither fraternity nor university will seek to influence the outcome of such appraisal, and such costs shall be borne by them equally. And what the university did here was they went out and commissioned new studies, decided those new studies might influence the appraiser, contacted the appraiser, provided them the information, and then asked them to go ahead and make an amended appraisal. That whole scenario is not permitted under the schedule and shouldn't be permitted. They shouldn't be permitted to do that. Otherwise, if you look at the language in the new appraisal, it contains the same sort of conditional language that if they received additional information, it might have an effect. I think that's recognized as sort of standard language you're going to get in an appraisal. And what it does is it opens it up that if we didn't like the outcome of the second appraisal, we now would have an opportunity to provide additional information and go through this sort of endless cycle as the Superior Court judge had indicated. And that's just simply not what was called for. The parties made a decision to have a certain mechanism in place. If the university didn't like having just an appraisal or the mechanism that this initial appraisal was going to use, they could have done something then. They could have said, no, we want to have an engineer take a look for potential hazardous materials. Instead, the appraiser said there's been no check for potentially hazardous materials. If they didn't like that condition up front, they could have said, no, it's going to be conditioned on having these certain tests done in the beginning. But they didn't do that. Everybody agreed on everybody agreed on a process. Everybody agreed with what the appraiser had done in the first place. And it's only because they didn't like the outcome that they then wanted to change the rules after the fact. And that's simply not what was called for under the reimbursement schedule.
What's the Delaware rule on an award of prejudgment interest?
It's permitted as a matter of right as of the time that the debt was owed.
Is your argument for prejudgment interest here conditioned at all on the fact that Delta had obligations in between the time they were owed the money and the time they were actually paid? Or is that irrelevant?
You mean the fact that we believe we had other claims we could press?
No, the
I'm
fact
sorry.
That you mentioned that you had an instrument of debt which Delta owed and interest kept accruing because you had no means to pay it. Is that at all contingent?
Well,
on the order of prejudgment interest?
I guess the reason I raise that is one of the reasons that parties are entitled to prejudgment interest is because when one party then gets control of the property, the other party is entitled to their money for it, and as long as the other party's now got control, they're entitled to interest until they get paid because of their possession of that asset.
Well, your position would be, I take it, that even if there were no instrument of debt on which you continued to owe principal and interest, you still would be entitled to
prejudgment. We still would, but I think this demonstrates why it's so important. Otherwise, we're not made whole in this case because we're continuing to accrue debt, penalty, and interest, and yet we don't have the money to pay it because the university doesn't want to pay it.
Okay.
I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd ask
you to save the balance of your time.
I would like to save the balance of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm William Manning. I'm representing the University of Delaware. Joining me at council table is James Taylor. We're both from the firm of Saul Ewing. As a preliminary matter, Your Honors, Rule 16D invites me as a cross-appellant to ask that some time be reserved as a reply, quote, as to the cross-appeal only. I make that request now, and I've been advised that your assistant has discussed that with you and that 5 minutes will be so reserved. Let me begin my argument, Your Honors, by observing that if the lower court's decision is affirmed, the university will end up paying more than twice what the appraiser believes the building is worth, or that the unexpired leasehold for that building is worth.
And as I understand the argument from your colleague, that would be entirely the fault of the university.
That is my colleague's argument. It's not correct. The first appraisal, all appraisals that you will see, the appraiser reserves the right to change the appraisal in the event that facts come to his or her attention, which would change his or her opinion of value. There was nothing inappropriate. So the university was invited to furnish facts when they became available to the university. The facts that render the building valueless were not known to the university at the time of the first appraisal and the initial engagement between the university and Delta Eta. But the appraiser, as was appropriate, said, here's my assumptions, no environmental conditions. I reserve the right to change this view if I am wrong about that. That's an invitation to the parties, I think, to furnish him with information that suggests that he was wrong about that. And this information came to light only after the complaint was filed, after our original answer was filed, and after the motion for summary judgment had been filed. It wasn't inappropriate for the university to furnish those facts, and I'll say two things about that. Number one, they were invited by the appraiser. Number two, this argument that is made today that the university acted improperly by furnishing anything to the appraiser is being heard for the first time. The lower court did not have the opportunity to consider that argument, and I don't think it should be considered here today.
Well, maybe you can clear this up for me.
Yes.
The reason that the first appraisal wasn't paid immediately was because you presented, or the university presented, a general release, which Delta refused to sign. Is that correct?
Thank you for inquiring. It wasn't paid immediately because Delta Eta, even before it filed its complaint, was saying, you owe us more than $768,500. The university said, we'll pay you the $768,000, but we need to know that we've paid everything that we're required to pay under the agreement. It is not fair to say that the university required a release that was broader than that, and my colleague continues to ignore the last letter in the exchange. That letter makes clear, we've referred to it in our briefs, that letter makes clear that the university was asking only for a release that was appropriately limited to the subject matter at hand. And in fact, the letter concludes by saying, if you agree that these particular claims, and I listed the claims that ultimately became, were reflected as counts 2 through 5 in the complaint, if you agree that these particular claims will be extinguished with the university's payment, then are there other claims contemplated by your client? While it may be that your client has other claims that are beyond the scope of the release to which the university is entitled, we may as well understand where we are. In other words, the university conceded that it was entitled only to a release that went to the claims that might have been brought under the agreements between the parties. And it was clear, at least as of the time of that letter, that the university was not seeking a release that was any broader than that to which it was entitled.
So did the university follow up with the lease worded differently than the general release that was just read to us?
I never got a response to that letter. That letter asks, do these claims, these four other claims that you're pressing, do you agree that with the lease, in fact, the lease, the release that you tendered, would those claims have been extinguished? We got no answer.
Okay, well, if Justice Jacobs were here, he'd say, is the answer to my question yes or no? Did the university ever tender another lease worded any differently than the general release we just read to us?
No, sir. Okay. The university instead responded that the release tendered by Delta Eta might be acceptable if Delta Eta had the same understanding of it that the university did.
Okay.
So it wasn't for lack of a document that this matter was never put to bed. The reason it was never put to bed is Delta Eta never would say one way or the other whether these other claims were appropriate given the release that it had asked for.
Okay. Now, I understand the building's been torn down, but for how many years did the university have control of the building?
Since the late 90s, I believe. The university leased the building from Delta Eta after Delta Eta had lost its privileges to be a fraternity house. And Delta Eta came to the university and said, gee, we have a problem. We can't pay our mortgage without income. We can't have income if we can't be a fraternity house. Will you help us? The university said yes. It subleased the house and put non-fraternity students' residence into that house.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because in the record, in the briefs, there's some indication that when the first appraisal was done, information was supplied that seemed to indicate there had been some mold problem.
Correct.
Minimal, but some mold problem.
Yes, sir.
But if the university has possession of the building since the 1990s, is it really a surprise for the university to say, you know, gosh, we've had this building since the 1990s, and we had no idea in this decade, 15 years that we had the building, that the building was worthless?
The university, what the university didn't know was that the cost to, by the reports of health problems cropped up much later than the late 90s. And that made the university inquire further. And the university found that simply scrubbing the mold on surfaces which were exposed and which you could reach and cleaning up the occasional water damage, those efforts would be futile because the conditions that create a health hazard were mold that couldn't be reached. And the university didn't know that until after it had filed its answer.
So they had possession of the building since the 1990s.
Yes, sir.
But the magnitude of their problem never became apparent to the university until after the first appraisal was done.
That is correct. And that was found by the lower court to be true. In her decision whether to grant leave to amend, the court accepts the facts that I've just submitted and says, okay, I buy that. We think where this case went wrong was the court below apprehended this case to be one in which, even though it wasn't our motion for summary judgment, the university was asking for relief from an appraisal. The cases cited by the court all involve an appraisal that sits there with the appraiser being firm in his or her conviction of the opinion of value and a party seeking to avoid the contractual implications of that appraisal. That's not this case at all. The university furnished, and it was not inappropriate for it to do so, information which neither it nor the appraiser had at the time of the first appraiser. The appraiser agreed that that changes his opinion of value, and he changed it. The university hasn't asked for relief from the appraiser's opinion, and in fact doesn't think that any is appropriate, believes that the court correctly concluded that absent a bias, mistake, or fraud, you're stuck with the results of the appraisal. And so the question becomes one of whether the appraiser changed his view and whether the university submitted facts that it didn't know before in a timely way. The answer would be no, but for the fact that Delta Eta was pressing its additional claims and therefore challenging the conclusion that $768,000, $500 would have been all that the university owed. But for that, 90 days after the first appraisal would have come and gone, and I don't think I could be standing here telling this court that I still have the opportunity to go back and ask the appraiser if his view would change with these new facts. But because the time for payment never arrived, 90 days after the date on which the full payment for full reimbursement has been established, and those are the words used in the agreement. Because that date never arrived, Delta Ada's litigation tactics permitted time for the university to discover new facts, which it did, and transmit those new facts. After having given those new facts to Delta Ada and the court weeks, or I guess months earlier, there was still time for the university to see if the appraiser had the same view. The appraiser has concluded not, and as I say, to let this result stand would...
So you really have identified the point of divergence of the parties. Their view is at the end of 90 days you should have written them a check, but you wanted this general release and they wouldn't agree to the general release. Your perspective is at the end of 90 days you would have given them a check, but they had these other claims. And so the real question is, who caused the delay that took this beyond the 90 days?
Yes, sir. If that 90-day period really did come and go, and if the university's payment was due 90 days after the first appraisal, I don't think I could be making these arguments. But it didn't. That deadline for payment didn't come and go because Delta Ada, not the university, Delta Ada challenged whether $768,500 would be all that the university owed. In fact, it asserted claims to more, even though those claims were easily captured by the lease and sublease and the various agreements. And so, having done that, and Your Honor mentioned a general release. We did submit a form of general release, but the exchange between the parties makes clear that Delta Ada's release, which was limited to matters arising under the various agreements, would have been acceptable, but we didn't realize, we couldn't figure out that. It wasn't clear that Delta Ada was reading its own document the same way we did. And I asked whether that was, whether they were or not, and I got no response. So I think that we did fairly respond to Delta Ada's concerns about the generality of the release. It's clear that we were only entitled, that we were only asserting an entitlement to a release that says, any claims arising under these agreements, you're done. 768.5 will take care of that entire obligation. We never got to that point, and the court below never considered these matters because these claims were subsequently withdrawn. And because of that, the deadline for payment never arrived until 90 days after the amount of full reimbursement had been, quote, established. That didn't really happen until Delta Ada withdrew its four other claims.
It didn't happen until they withdrew their claims or until the Superior Court verdict?
No. If the question is, when was the university obliged to pay an amount? When was the amount known? The amount was not known until the cloud over that amount was removed.
Okay, and that
only happened when Delta Ada withdrew its four counts.
And that would have been before the Superior Court decision?
No, that was after.
Let me ask for some help here on the chronology. Those
four counts were dismissed in March of 2009. And so if the court says, well, Manning, under your view, what's that date, 90 days after when the amount was established, that would be 90 days after March of 2009.
So is it your position that this language has been established and communicated to the university, takes this out of the general rule on prejudgment interest as to when the amount is legally due? We have contract disputes that are going to go through a trial and litigation and ultimately a judgment. And if it's that judgment or somebody withdrawing the claims in the litigation that determines when it's legally due, that seems to be foreign to the concept of prejudgment interest because that could be very close to the judgment or the date of the judgment.
When the party to be paid itself challenges the amount of payment, then I think that's different. The payor has no idea what payment will achieve the finality that he's entitled to. That was the case here, and so I'm not suggesting any modification of what I understand the general rule to be, which is as soon as the amount is determined, liquidated, as is a word used in some cases, prejudgment interest should begin to run on that date. How could the amount be determined when the person entitled, the party entitled to the payment of that amount, was questioning it?
Well, there seem to be two concepts, though. The university was obligated to make the payment pursuant to the appraisal. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And that was the entire agreement.
Yes,
sir.
So
the appraisal quantified the amount due under the terms of the agreement. And then what we see is the other side said, well, that's fine with regard to the appraisal, but we're entitled to some other money. Isn't that what they were really saying? Now, you're saying they were interrelated because the origin of those other claims related to the house, but there really were two separate issues. What did the appraisal obligate the university to pay, and how much did they want in additional to the appraisal for other things?
The attempt to establish those four other claims as being outside of the agreements is being made here for the first time. The trial court never had the opportunity to test the argument that you've heard today from Delta Eta, which is that these were wholly separate claims, as if a Delta Eta employee had been injured by a university truck or something. The Delta Eta never suggested before that they were outside of the various agreements. I don't believe they are. And in any event, that's a determination. If that's a claim that Delta Eta wants to make, it should have been made to the trial court.
Well, as I understood what Mr. Cross said in his opening remarks is when he tendered his release, which you said might have been acceptable to you if you could have agreed on the terms, he wasn't going to agree on the terms because he was trying to leave his options open. And if his client decided to pursue those other four claims, you could assert the release as an affirmative defense, but he wasn't going to tell you that the terms of his release accomplished your goal.
The fact is he didn't tell me anything. We got no response from Delta
Eta. No, I understand that. But this morning, this afternoon, that's basically what he said, that if you would have gone forward with his release, he was going to let it speak for itself, and he may or may not have pursued his other claims, and then you could or could not assert the release as the defense.
He never asserted that before either. In other words, this exchange has been going on for a long time, and the trial court has heard this very argument, and nowhere did Delta Eta say, no, we don't have to tell you whether our claims are extinguished by the release that we've tendered. We understand Manning's confusion. They seem to be, if his view is right, that they arise under the various agreements. We're just not going to say anything about that, and instead, we're going to press our luck, which it did. And entitled to do that.
Now, from the 1990s, when the university got possession of the building, they were paying rent. Is that correct?
The university was making payments to Delta Eta so that Delta Eta could meet its debt service obligations.
And when did the university stop paying Delta Eta?
It didn't stop paying. I guess upon termination of the lease, because from that point forward, I apologize for being confusing on that. When the lease was terminated, then the university had an obligation to pay other things, which was the amount that would be determined by the reimbursement schedule.
So give me a ballpark on a year for that. 2006? 2006 or?
When the university, the notice of termination of the lease was? June 30, 06.
So since June 30, 06, Delta Eta has gotten no money from the University of Delaware at all. Is that correct?
That's true. All it had was the university's offer to pay $768,000 if the university could, if it would get acknowledgement in return that was all it was owed under the various agreements. So the Delta Eta could have had actually an amount that, as we now know today, is twice what the house is worth, and simply chose not to accept it. Your Honor, I had reserved, Your Honors, I had reserved 5 minutes. I see that I have 32 seconds remaining. And so if the court has questions, about which it would like to hear from me after Mr. Cross completes his remarks, I'd appreciate being asked. But other than that, I think it would be inappropriate if I tried to take more than the 10 seconds that remain. Thank you.
If I could address a few points. First, I think as Mr. Manning said early in his remarks, the appraisal contained language that suggested that the appraiser may adjust that number. And he said, as you will see, it's contained in all appraisals. And that's a point I raised as well. So I don't think that the appraiser, in giving that first appraisal, was attempting to say this is just a preliminary appraisal or that it wasn't intended to be the final appraisal. I think everyone operated under the belief, and I don't think it was a mistaken belief, that under the Chapter House reimbursement schedule, there was going to be an appraisal made. It was made. That appraisal was transmitted in August of 2006. And to suggest that you could go back and that there was some mechanism to allow for an amended or second appraisal just simply isn't found in the agreement. And if the parties had wanted that, they could have bargained for it, but they didn't. Mr. Counsel for University.
So does that mean the appraiser was not permitted to say that he reserved the right to correct any mistake he made?
Well, I think the appraiser can say anything he wants when he makes his appraisal. I don't know if it legally, once he issues that opinion, once that calculation is made under the reimbursement schedule, and once it's transmitted to the university, I think it's done. For the appraiser to then say, well, now I'm going to change that, I don't think is called for under the agreement. We can't control necessarily what the appraiser is going to write in that report in that way. And I think, like I said, it's a standard language, as Mr. Manning said. To suggest that it's okay for the appraiser to amend it opens up, in any case where there's an appraisal, the idea that parties will go and get sort of serial appraisals when they don't like the answer, because the language, as Mr. Manning and I have said, is found in all appraisals.
I'm having some difficulty understanding how there can be such a fundamental difference in your approach to the facts about why the money proffered wasn't accepted and why there was this controversy over the form of release. I had the impression from your argument the matter wasn't settled because they wanted Delta to sign a general release. Now I hear no, that it was because you were pressing other claims under the agreement that would clearly fall under the agreement, but in excess of the appraisal amount. What's your position on that?
Sure. Our claims, I'm not suggesting our claims don't have any relationship to the lease, the second lease and the sublease. I'm not suggesting that they're wholly unrelated somehow. What I'm saying is the Chapter House reimbursement schedule calls for a payment that is in exchange for early transfer of title and possession of the house back to the university. If the language of the Chapter House reimbursement schedule said, we are going to make a payment based on an appraisal in the event we early terminate, and that payment will constitute full and final payment of all claims that you may have, then we probably wouldn't be here today. But it doesn't say that. It simply says, we're going to have to make a calculation as to the future value of this lease that we're terminating early, and we're going to have to reimburse you for it. It's not suggesting anything about other claims that might exist under the leases and sublease. And so our position was, yes, we're entitled to the $768,500, and we were not pressing and saying we're refusing to take the $768,500 unless you make other payments. In fact, our letter of December 4 at the appendix at 322 is specifically saying we are entitled to immediately be paid the $768,500, and that's what we asked for. The fact that we believe we had separate claims under the leases and sublease has nothing to do with the Chapter House reimbursement schedule.
Well, here's why I'm confused. I heard in your first argument that the reason the matter wasn't resolved because you were presented with a general release that went well beyond what was called for under the lease arrangement.
Yes.
Then I hear that, no, there was an offer by the University of Delaware to have a more subscribed or circumscribed release that related only to claims that arose out of the lease. and that the reason they didn't pay you the amount that you demanded was because they were uncertain as to the amount of your final claims, or they would take a release for the $768,000.
Sure. There is no requirement under the Chapter House reimbursement schedule to provide a release of any kind. The university demanded a very broad release. We came back to them in one letter and said, there's no requirement to provide you a release of any kind. Please show us where it is. I see my time is up. Can I finish my answer? And we said to the university, show us where it says in the schedule that we have to provide you a release. The university came back and said, you have told us you believe you may have some other claims, so we're not going to give you a release. We're not going to give you your money unless you provide us a full release. We came back to them in a letter.
Now, that's where I'm confused. What do you mean when you use the term a full release?
I mean the initial release, the language of which I read to you before, which said any and all claims, including claims under the lease, sublease, and Chapter House reimbursement schedule. So it would have...
Well, you heard Mr. Manning say and read from a letter that suggested at least that it was the university's understanding that they narrowed their request to a lease to claims to a release for claims solely arising out of the lease arrangement,
right,
not unrelated claims that might be in the future or.
And if I could, let me see if I have these letters up here. There is a letter. Which we had sent to the university on December 20, 2006. It starts at in the appendix at 326, and then it goes on to 327. That letter is where we come back to the university and again reiterate, we don't believe we are required to give you any sort of release. The Chapter House reimbursement schedule doesn't call for it. We're not obligated to give you one. But notwithstanding that, we will give you a limited release. We offered that. Delta Eta did. We offered to give them a limited release, and we told them the proposed language in the letter. We didn't provide them with a draft release document. We provided them with the language in a letter that we said would be acceptable to us.
All right. What was the date of that letter?
That letter is dated December 20, 2006, and in which we say that we would give them a release, and we said it would be it's a fairly long release, but ultimately it says, arising out of or in any way relating to the ground lease, the supplemental lease, and the Chapter House lease and land sublease.
Now, as I understood Mr. Manning, he wrote back to you after that,
right,
and said, does your language cover those four other claims?
Yes.
And that you never responded.
Well, and I think that, and here's what happens. He sends a letter back in December 26, 2006. That letter is Bates numbered in Appendix A366 and 367. That letter does not make a tender or an offer of any kind. If you read that letter, it's a series of questions by Mr. Manning. It's unfortunate, and we went back, and it's not part of the record, so I don't know how much the court wants me to get into this. We went back and looked because it did surprise us as well. There's subsequent emails between myself and Mr. Manning and Ms. Evans and Mr. Manning in which we had sent some emails to Mr. Manning that never arrived. What happened was I had inverted two of the letters in his firm's email address. So there were a couple of emails that went out sometime in January of 2007 in which we were discussing this. I then ran into Mr. Manning, and Mr. Manning acknowledges this in an email. I ran into him sometime, I think it was in February or March of 2007, and said, I never heard back from you in my response to you. He said, I'm sorry, and we realized that there had been this confusion. By April of 2007, the parties' positions had been they wanted a complete release, and we were only willing to give them a release as to the lease and sublease. And so ultimately we filed our lawsuit saying we should not have to give this more general release.
Okay. I do want to give Mr. Manning a chance to reply to that.
Thank you.
I continue to be confused over who struck John here, if that's not a very legal term. But
I apologize on behalf of all the parties for the confusion. And I'm hearing things that I don't agree with and are certainly not part of the record. The release tendered by Delta Eta with its December 20 letter. You heard Mr. Cross concede that the claims which he was making, these four other claims,
did relate to the leases or the subleases or whatever all these agreements were. And the release which he tendered would have extinguished those claims, because the release which he tendered extinguished claims which arise out of or in any way are relating to the ground lease, the supplemental lease, and the chapter house lease, and the land sublease. And so the question that Your Honor has acknowledged that I made in the responsive letter was, okay, I don't understand how you can have these claims outstanding at the same time give us this release. We read it differently. So tell me, so that I can understand, and I'm quoting from my letter, where our differences lie, let me ask whether you agree that the claims arising under the schedule are included with the potential claims under the ground lease that should be extinguished when the university makes its payment. We've conceded that we never got an answer to that, and there's nothing in the record, and I will tell the court, there's nothing in my recollection which suggests that the university went back to a position which Delta Eta had criticized it for and went back to asking for a release that was too broad. Delta Eta knew, the university knew, that the university was only asking for a request for a release of claims arising under these various agreements.
Okay. Well,
thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, we'll try to sort through this as best we can, and if we have any further questions about the state of the record or supplement the record, we'll get back to you about it.
Thank you, Your Honor.